Welcome back to our Inside Arbitration podcast, hosted by me, Liz Cantor.
And me, Vanessa Naish. So today we are joined by the lovely Hannah Ambrose, who is a partner in our London team. Welcome, Hannah.
Hello.
In our podcast today, we wanted to discuss two exciting developments in the world of arbitration. And the first one is the Court of Appeals judgment in the UniCredit versus Ruscombe Alliance case. And the second is the draft English arbitration bill, which is currently under review by a House of Lords special committee.
Yes, and of course, although these are two separate developments, we thought we'd discuss them together, focusing on a particular topic where they actually do overlap, and that's the law governing the arbitration agreement. This is an important change being proposed by the Law Commission in the arbitration bill that's currently before Parliament. And it was also a central point of discussion in the UniCredit case, which Vanessa and I had the opportunity to attend for the hearing. And of course, it's also discussed at length in the judgment that was handed down.
Brilliant. Okay, so shall we start by doing a bit of scene setting? Liz, do you maybe want to start us off by explaining what the law governing the arbitration agreement is and why it matters?
Yes, good plan. So in most jurisdictions, it's possible for an arbitration clause to be governed by a different law from the rest of the contract, which we sometimes call the matrix contract. That is because an arbitration clause has a different purpose and subject matter from the rest of the contract, as it's concerned with how disputes are to be resolved. It is also sometimes considered to be separable from the contract in which it is contained, i.e. it can be treated as a separate contract. And that's because if one party argues that the wider contract itself isn't binding in some way, it ensures that you can actually still arbitrate the dispute about whether or not the contract is binding. So the arbitration agreement needs its own law, which will determine things like the scope, effect, construction, and validity of the arbitration clause. This rule is actually codified in the English Arbitration Act through Section 7, which confirms that an arbitration clause can be considered separable for the specific purpose of determining validity or enforceability, either of the arbitration clause or the matrix contract.
And that's why you said that an arbitration clause is sometimes separable, as at least under English law, because under Section 7, separability should only matter for those specific purposes.
Yes, exactly. And that's what the Supreme Court said in the leading judgment in Enker and Chubb, which I will come back to in a moment.
And what you're talking about matters in all sorts of contexts, particularly where there's a dispute about what the arbitration clause is intended to cover. And obviously, this can have some pretty important consequences. So there's a case from nearly a decade ago, which is called Sul America. And it really mattered whether the arbitration agreement was covered by it was governed by English law or by Brazilian law. And if it was covered, was governed by the latter, then the agreement to arbitrate was not enforceable. And another obvious example of where the governing law of an arbitration agreement matters is in the context of anti-suit injunctions in the English courts. And as we'll come on to discuss when we talk about the UniCredit case, that law can affect whether or not the English courts will take jurisdiction.
That's right. Now, in an ideal world, parties will specify which law applies to the arbitration agreement either in their arbitration clause itself, or they might include language in the governing law clause that says that that governing law clause also extends to the arbitration clause. But obviously, that doesn't always happen. If the parties don't expressly specify which law applies to their arbitration agreement, then they might end up having a whole dispute about which law governs it. In turn, as you just indicated, Vanessa, that might affect whether an ASI can be granted or indeed whether the arbitration agreement is valid. And then it becomes necessary for a court or an arbitral tribunal to actually conduct an inquiry into the issue to resolve it.
And in basic terms, there are generally two contenders here for which law it could be. So that will either be the law governing the matrix contract or the law of the seat.
Correct. And after a series of judgments on this point, the position in England on how this inquiry should be carried out was clarified by the Supreme Court in the case of Enker and Chubb.
Oh, you're going to talk us through Enker and Chubb. It's a horrible, long and complicated judgment. So good luck to you.
Well, you know, I love a challenge. So essentially, the Supreme Court said that the first step is to look for an express choice of law to govern the arbitration agreement. So that's why, as I already mentioned, and it's ideal to specify this in the arbitration clause or as part of the governing law clause. But if no express choice can be discerned, then, subject to some exceptions, the choice of law governing the matrix contract will generally be viewed as being an implied choice that also applies to the arbitration agreement. I mention that there are some exceptions because one of them was actually the subject of much discussion in the UniCredit case, although I won't go into that now. There's also the situation where the parties have not chosen the governing law of the main contract either. That's actually what happened in the Enke case. So in those circumstances, the court applies a slightly different test to work out the law of the arbitration agreement by looking for the law with the closest connection. This will usually be the law of the seat, where the parties have chosen a seat. Now, obviously, that's an oversimplification, and there are some exceptions, as I mentioned, but hopefully that will suffice for our purposes.
Well done. Brilliant. OK, right. So now we know in our outline at least what Enke and Chubb said. Hannah, can I bring you in to discuss the Law Commission's consultation and the proposal on governing law in the draft bill?
Absolutely. So the Law Commission began a series of consultations into the possible reform of the Arbitration Act 1996 in September 2022 with the launch of its first consultation paper. And the governing law of the arbitration agreement didn't actually factor in that original list of potential changes. But following input from a considerable number of consultees, the issue made its way into the second consultation paper. So 36 of the consultees to the second paper, I believe, said that they were in favour of a default rule to be confirmed in the statute, which took a different approach from Enke. They were in favour of a default rule that confirmed that unless the parties have expressly agreed which law governs the arbitration agreement, then it should be the law of the seat and not the governing law of the matrix contract.
Yeah, should we talk about why these consultees were in favour of that change?
Yeah, so the first point is that Enke and Chubb, as Vanessa said, is really complex and actually quite nuanced. So while the Supreme Court no doubt hoped its judgment would bring about clarity, many people suggest that it hasn't done. It's a really long judgment, and it really just still leaves room for argument as to when there is a choice of law, for example, through implied choice, and then whether that choice is displaced, as we'll come on to shortly.
And I guess because all of it's set out in case law and not in statute, lots of parties might find themselves subject to the rule in Enke and Chubb without necessarily even being aware of it.
Yeah, and I think Enke and Chubb has divided opinions for this reason. So some argue that parties make a clear decision on the governing law of their contracts, as in the matrix contract, the substantive provisions, and that very few appreciate that an arbitration agreement can actually be separable or subject to a different law. So I think they would therefore expect their arbitration agreement, like all the rest of the terms, to be governed by the law of the matrix contract, i.e. following the logic of Enke.
Yeah, but also others argue that the parties choose the seat of their arbitration for a reason and would expect that choice of seat to govern everything about their arbitration, including the validity, scope, effect and construction of the arbitration clause. This would therefore suggest that the law of the seat should govern the arbitration agreement.
And at the risk of being slightly controversial, Liz, there's also a bit of a sort of a protectionist angle to the argument that you raised too. Obviously, England's a very popular seat of arbitration and often chosen alongside foreign law governed contracts. So changing the rule to mean that the law of the seat will also be the governing law of the arbitration agreement obviously means that disputes about that would then go to the English court.
Yeah, I mean, playing a devil's advocate, though, the opposite could be argued, too. So English law is used all around the world to govern contractual arrangements. And the Enke and Chubb rule potentially brings English law governed arbitration agreements, but with a foreign seat before the English courts. So changing the rule away from Enke and Chubb, as is proposed, would stop that happening. Generally, this was just a polarising issue. But the end result of the consultation was that the Law Commission went ahead with the proposal, and the majority of respondents to their consultation agreed that it would bring welcome clarity and simplicity to what has been a really complex issue. This is dealt with in the new Section 6A of the Arbitration Bill. And this provides that in the absence of express agreement to the contrary, the governing law of the arbitration agreement is the law of the seat. And in terms of timing, which is obviously also important, this will apply to all arbitration agreements, whether concluded before or after the draft bill comes into force. But unless arbitration proceedings or court proceedings relating to those arbitration proceedings have been commenced already.
Yes, and from the written and oral evidence that's been given to the House of Lords Special Committee recently, it does seem as though the majority of the practitioners, judges, and users of arbitration who have given evidence do agree with the policy that sits behind the proposal, as well as this timing point, though it looks likely that there'll be some tinkering with the specific wording.
Brilliant. Right, Hannah, your comment on English law governed foreign seated arbitrations actually gives us quite a nice segue into talking about UniCredits. So the UniCredit decision is the latest in a series of applications to the English courts on materially the same facts. And in each of those cases, a bank has applied for an anti-suit injunction preventing a company called Ruscam Alliance from continuing Russian proceedings in breach of an arbitration agreement. Now, in each of those cases, there were English law governed bonds with a Paris-seated ICC arbitration clause and no express choice of law to govern the arbitration agreement. Hannah, can I turn this back to you again? Why did the law of the arbitration agreement matter in this context?
That's a very good question. Look, we've already talked about how the law governing the arbitration agreement matters in terms of an anti-suit injunction. But the answer to why that's actually the case is actually not immediately obvious, I don't think. The well-known case of AES confirms that the court can grant an ASI under Section 37 of the Senior Courts Act to enforce an arbitration agreement between the parties, even in circumstances where no arbitration has been commenced. However, in order that the court can grant an ASI under Section 37, UniCredit had to show that the English court had personal jurisdiction over that foreign defendant. And that personal jurisdiction needs to be proven under the requirements of the English civil procedure rules. And in this instance, with a foreign seat and a foreign respondent party, UniCredit needed to fit within the jurisdictional gateway in CPR 6. So to get really technical for a moment, UniCredit relied on the governing law gateway under paragraph 3.16c of Practice Direction 6b, i.e. that the claim being brought was in respect of a contract governed by English law. Now, the Practice Direction does say contract and not arbitration agreement. However, as we've already discussed, an arbitration agreement is sometimes treated as a separate agreement to the main contract, as the Court of Appeal in UniCredit actually explicitly acknowledged. So as a result, parties have argued, and in UniCredit, the court expressly decided, of course, that the arbitration agreement, rather than the matrix contract, had to be governed by English law for the governing law gateway to apply. The court also had to be satisfied that England was the proper place to bring the claim in order to give permission to serve out of the jurisdiction.
And applying ENCA, which is still obviously the law on this issue until the arbitration bill is passed, the Court of Appeal found that English law did apply to the arbitration agreement because it was the governing law of the contract and no exception applied. So it rejected Ruscam Alliance's argument that French law, which was chosen by the parties of the seat, governed the arbitration clause. I won't go into the detail of that argument for now, as I think what's interesting here is that the UniCredit case is a great illustration of the impact of the difference between the current ENCA regime and the Law Commission's proposals. Because obviously, although the Court of Appeal determined in following ENCA that English law applied to the arbitration agreement here, if the new regime were to be in place, then obviously the law of the arbitration agreement would have been French law because the parties had chosen a French seat. And then, of course, the consequence of that is that there would have been no jurisdiction for the English court to actually grant the ASI.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting conundrum in terms of the reach of the English court. What's the policy goal here and what's the right outcome? On the one hand, I think we would want the English court to be able to weigh in, particularly in cases like this, where the ASI would not have been available in France. And there is some connection with English law. And based on this interpretation of the jurisdictional gateways, though, the new proposed bill would mean that the English court may not be able to grant an anti-suit in those circumstances. But on the other hand, should the English court be able to grant an ASI for every contract just because it's governed by English law? Or should this choice of seat be the determining factor?
Yeah, really tricky decision there. And it's also not clear, obviously, whether the Court of Appeals decision will be appealed and what then the Supreme Court might have to say about this. Now, one possibility to fix the conundrum that Hannah just mentioned is that the jurisdictional gateways could be changed if there is a significant concern prompted by the proposals for the new arbitration bill, example, you know, perhaps CPR 62, which itself provides for service out of the jurisdiction, could be tweaked in some way so that it extends to ASIs under Section 37 of the Senior Courts Act, clarifying in what circumstances ASIs can be granted. For example, either if the seat is England and Wales, or if the governing law of the arbitration agreement or the contract is England, or indeed there could be some other discretionary test.
Yes, so in short, this jurisdictional gateway issue might be fixable another way, and preserving the complexity of ENCA is not necessarily the solution to all of this. Right, well, we've discussed a lot today, so I think let's stop there, but we can definitely revisit this if there are any more developments on this issue. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Liz.